Gresham College presents Is Theatre History? The Alternative Explosion by Sam Waters.
The theatre is clearly thriving at the moment. In last Monday's Evening Standard, there was a piece that said National's record 80 million year of hits. The National Theatre made a record 80 million last year, more than double its income a decade ago. So, compared with when I was a young man, with only the Royal Court, Stratford East and the Old Vic outside the West End, the theatre-goer of today is spoilt for choice, almost too much choice, one might think. There have clearly been periods when there have been explosions of theatre, when theatre dominated. The Elizabethan, Jacobean period, obviously. The Restoration period, when after time of being censored and not existing, the theatre came flying back. And the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, with Chekhov and Ibsen, Strindberg, Shaw, Granville Barker, and many more writing, and the beginning of, as it were, modern theatre. And then nearer our own time, of course, there was 1956, and the Royal Court, and a slight explosion around that time, and around 1968, I suppose, with all the political upheavals of the time, the fringe and alternative theatre movement that is still with us today appeared. Theatre, of course, reflects the times that it is in. And the 1960s were a great period of change, indeed almost of, in inverted commas, revolution. There were the Vietnam War, anti-Vietnam War demonstrations. I'm sure lots of you were involved in them. Sit-ins at universities, you perhaps were involved in those too. The French government was nearly brought down by a combination of workers and students. The Prague Spring ended with repression in 1968 by the Soviet Union. And in this country, sit-ins at universities, riots in Grosvenor Square, Carnaby Street, the Beatles, miniskirts crawling up the girls' legs, and the end of criminalisation of homosexuality and the abolishing of the Lord Chamberlain's office and therefore the censoring of plays. Clearly, an awful lot was happening, and the confines of the Second World War that we had still lived with in the 1950s were at last being thrown off, and theatre in the UK at that time reflected the changes. Now, in the alternative explosion, that is my secondary title, as it were, the first wave of that that happened perhaps from 1968 onwards for a bit was politically and socially motivated, I think, perhaps more than the later second move. People wanted to take theatre to the factory gates, out to the villages, and they had often political and social things that they wanted to say and do. The second wave, of which the Orange Tree was a part, were theatres in often upstairs pub rooms and basements. The upstairs large room in a pub had once had a purpose, had lost its purpose. And so you could indeed go to a landlord. You had to have a drink. You're quite right. You had to have a drink first before you said, have you got a room where we can put on a play, please? No censor now, you see. So clothes could come flying off, and the language was free to be hurled at the audiences. So there was an explosion of activity. Of course, many of the companies of that time and the people who drove them have now disappeared. So perhaps has some of the excitement and spontaneity. And those that have survived have now become part of the establishment and put down concrete roots, the tricycle, the bush, the Soho and the Orange Tree, and the newer and perhaps grander boys, newer, I must emphasise, the Almeida and the Donmar. And now, being, alas, grown up, we have to grapple with the consequences, rules and regulations, health and safety, governance, forward planning, the providing of information, and a plethora of application forms. We didn't have to do any of that in 1971. Eventually we did, and partly to please Anthony Field, who is a speaker here in 2 weeks' time because he was the finance director of the Arts Council, and if he was going to get any money, he wanted to know what we were doing with the stuff he gave us. But there are now, as well as the established alternative theatres, new boys and girls on the block, as the indomitable Blanche Marvin, now well into her 80s and virtually a one-woman band, makes clear when awarding her Peter Brook Empty Space Awards. This year's happened to be next month, as does Blanche's appearance on Desert Island Discs. Listen out for it. Today, of course, theatre's now very respectable. It was not always so. The rot, I suppose, set in when Henry Irving got his knighthood. 50 years earlier, polite society was very wary of Edmund Kean. And by the end of the 19th century, of course, Irving's knighthood was followed by many others. Mind you, fathers may still have thrown thespian inclining daughters out of the house on the grounds that they were becoming, to all intents and purposes, members of an immoral profession well into the 20th century. And certainly when I was young, in the 1950s, theatre was entirely discouraged as any sort of profession for anyone who had a possibility of doing something else. But today, all that's changed. Theatre, drama, is taught in school. It's a school subject. In the early 1950s, there was one university drama department, and it had just been created in the face of considerable opposition at Bristol. Now, they are all over the place. And television, of course, brings reality performing competitions into everyone's home, and thousands of people aspire to be performers of one kind or another, and are encouraged to do so. There are no objecting fathers now. We all, after all, live in the celebrity age. And if you think you've got a chance of becoming one, you go for it. But, when the young study drama and performing arts at school, when they do a course at university, is it to the theatre that they are looking, or is it to film and television? And now, indeed, to other digital forms of communication. Do the young, who on the face of it seem to have theatre, drama and performing arts as part of their lives, take an interest in the theatre? Some questions. If drama theatre is a school subject, is it something that you go out and do for fun on a Friday night? When my wife, Auriel Smith, was directing a production at the Stephen Joseph Theatre in Scarborough, which is a 2-auditorium in a converted cinema, I was standing waiting for her one lunchtime when two young girls came in and went up to the box office and said, "Is there a film on tonight?" Now, the two theatres, the Theatre in the Round, the big one, do plays only, but the McCarthy Theatre, the small one, is a little this sort of size, and sometimes it operates as a cinema. So it was a legitimate question, is there a film on? No, there wasn't, said the box office person. The girls then went into a little huddle and started to talk about what they might therefore do that night. They were 17, 18, 19, I don't know their age, but I was interested to listen as best I could to their conversation. They had no problem crossing the threshold into the theatre. It wasn't an alien building holding up its hand and saying, "This isn't a place for you." They'd come into it. They seemed to know it. They had probably been before and seen a film. The two plays that were on that night, because there were plays in both the theatres, were perfectly suitable for them, would have provided them with an absolutely acceptable form of entertainment for the evening, but not for one minute did they ask, nor did the box office, I have to say, try and tell them. Not for one minute did they check what was on if there wasn't a film. It simply wasn't on their agenda. So are theatres right to be worried when they observe that their audiences are perhaps tending towards the elderly? Does studying drama really mean studying film? And also, has the new digital media with YouTube, Facebook, texting, tweeting, turned almost everyone into show-offs who want to parade themselves in public? Have we turned everyone into potential performers and lost an audience? Are people going to want to sit still and quiet and attentive in the theatre and become the audiences of tomorrow? Or is the theatre, despite the appearances and the National Theatre's soaring profits, in fact, yesterday's art form? Is theatre as we knew it already history? So once upon a time, if you wanted to tell a story or to have a story told to you, theatre plays were the only way it could happen. There were no papers, there were no magazines, there were no novels. So Shakespeare and his contemporaries had it their own way. A writer wrote plays. Perhaps some wrote epic poems, but the plays were the thing. And that continued until we get to the 19th century. That became the century of the novel. So writers turned often to the novel, and the quality of plays, as we noticed, diminished. But star actors, Kean, Macready, Irving, they still dominated. Then, at the end of the 19th century, as I have already implied, from roughly 1890 to the First World War, there was a hugely fertile time for the theatre. This was partly because, as with other flourishing periods, it was a time of political and social change. In this country, the Irish question, the foundation of the Labour Party, the campaign for votes for women, and then there was revolution in Russia and the First World War. It was a time when underneath the surface of the lives that we were all leading, there was change bubbling away. No wonder it produced Grove's great playwrights and many others who we take a pleasure in trying to unearth occasionally, who were writing about the changes that they felt were coming in society. And not only were they great playwrights, but they were great directors too, especially Stanislavski in Russia, whose basic ideas about what acting is and how to do it still hold sway today. But at the very time when modern theatre was being born, ironically, at exactly the same time, film was being discovered. And in our context, the 20th century became, in fact, the century of first film and then, roughly halfway through, television. Stories could now be told and acted in new ways. For the first time, the supremacy of the theatre was going to be really challenged. Now, with the 21st century and the plethora of television channels, DVDs, computers, and even phones on which you can be entertained, and with the ever-expanding world of the new digital media, the threat continues. So although the theatre may have lost its dominance in the 20th century, it would seem that it has still managed to survive. But will it survive into the future? My contention is that it may survive, but only if it utilises and exploits what makes it different and unique. It must not, in my opinion, try to rival or emulate what its competitors do, but rather retrench and concentrate on what makes it different and special. And if it does that, it may find that the brave new world into which we have entered will, surprisingly, give the theatre a new lease of life. But we do have to be aware that the young of today, theatre can to them seem like yesterday's news. The Greeks did it, for heaven's sake, rather well. Shakespeare did it better than anyone has ever done it since. And his contemporaries were pretty good too. Who wants to be interested in something that was done best 400 years ago? Granny may have liked Noel Coward, and the parents may witter on about Look Back in Anger and Waiting for Godot. But what has that got to do with my life, the young may say. We have our own stuff, and it's on film. And we can download almost anything we want. And we can eat and drink while we watch. And we can stop it and take a break. And we don't have to go out to some special stuffy place and sit with a lot of strangers. We can watch the stuff at home or go round to our mates. And we can carry on receiving texts or even making phone calls if we want. And film is real. A few years ago, I was in the hairdressers. That's not something I do very often. I'm delighted to say, have a stage manager at the Orange Tree, and I bought one of those sort of clippers, and I get my hair cut by her. It's part of the job. I claim that what I'm doing is extending their horizons so that when the theatre does collapse, if it does, they can do something else. Now, this is a piece that I found in an Esquire magazine sitting in the hairdressers. It was some years ago. It has a reference that is a little to Hollywood actresses coming over here and taking their clothes off, which clearly refers to a particular performance or two in the past. But I asked the man who ran the hairdressing shop if I could have the magazine, and he said yes. The heading of the is The Indefensible Position. So obviously every week somebody put forward ideas that might annoy or provoke. And this is by the journalist and comedian Dom Jolly, who some of you may read occasionally. I'm not quite sure who he is. I should have looked it up. I was going to and forgot. As one can look everything up nowadays at the touch of a button. This is entitled All Theatres Should Be Burnt to the Ground. Well, it caught my attention. I'm not a Philistine, he writes. I've been to many theatrical performances, although I have never, unfortunately, been able to sit through an entire one. I have a good working knowledge of the first acts of most theatrical classics and can therefore speak with no little knowledge of the subject. Theatre is arse. It's an antiquated institution that allows grown men to wear women's clothing and recite someone else's bollocks very loudly in a decidedly hammy manner. I understand how all this came about. In caveman times, when there was little else to do apart from clubbing dinosaurs and rutting your mate, some of the more extrovert cave dwellers started to grunt stories to the thicker cave dwellers in an attempt to keep them amused. This developed into full-blown theatre, with props, costumes, sets and loveys. By the Middle Ages, peasants were kept amused in large buildings where they would stand for hours watching campmen in gaudy costumes recite tedious verse. Here's the news. We've got telly now. We've got the cinema. We don't need to suspend disbelief and pretend that the scrappy backdrop means that the story is set in Venice. We can actually film stories in Venice now. Not only that, but the stories can be realistic, intelligible, and interesting. Theatre breeds loveys, terrible bores who ponce around wearing neckerchiefs and calling everyone darling while comparing ordinary situations to Ionesco. Enough is enough. It's time for the final curtain, the ultimate pinter pause to be wreaked on these god-awful places. We must burn every theatre in the land down. The UK would be a better place. There would be nowhere for burnt-out, wrinkly Hollywood actresses to come to attempt to rekindle their careers by scaring people with their nude bodies. There would be no reason for country people to come and annoy city folk by coming to town to take in a show. People who wanted to write musicals based on the work of Kajagoogoo, I have no idea who they are, but don't let them know that, I was told by a colleague, the work of Kajagoogoo would have to leave the country and seek to work, to seek work, and we would never have to see Donald Sinden again. That's a bit cruel. There really is no argument. Burn, baby, burn. So that's what he read. He wrote. Does the Cannes Theatre compete with the telly and the film? Well, and why should we bother? And if we do keep on with the good fight, how should we do it? But we must ask ourselves what makes theatre different. What justifies its continuation in our brave new world? What makes theatre special? The main answer to that, and far and away for me the most important one, is that theatre is a shared experience. It's not for nothing, there's a company called that. Nowadays, you see, we can shop online. And how I disapprove of the emails I get from Waitrose offering me rewards to induce me to buy online. What are they doing? Instead of going to their shop and keeping the town centre alive and giving employment to the cashiers and the shelf fillers, they want me to buy online so it can go from a warehouse into a lorry to my house. We can even get our money out of the bank without going into it. When my young daughter, who's now not so young, was starting to earn her living as a ballet dancer, she had a bank account and a salary going into it. She came to me one day and said, "Dad, what do I do when I want some money and the hole in the wall says it's out of service?" I said, "Well, you go into the bank, darling." "What?" I said, "You could go in and talk to somebody." She'd had a bank account. She was perfectly capable of dealing with her business, but she'd never been into a bank account, into a bank. She didn't realise there were human beings in there, perhaps, to whom you could relate. She's now does her banking through Intelligent Finance or something. I think it's all done online. I don't know. She's still online. She's a technically accomplished young woman. So we can communicate with our friends, and we can even work at home, all without making contact with other human beings. If we go to the cinema or watch television or a DVD or use our computer, it is a private activity. Our work and our leisure are more and more able to be solitary activities, and we travel on our own in enclosed cars rather than on public transport, and who wouldn't, given the choice, you might say. So life is in danger of driving us more and more apart, and if that's what we want, then it is what we can probably easily have. The future could be solitary. But human beings are gregarious creatures. So if our desire, if our need is to have contact, if we want to be part of a group, to live in a community, if we want contact both casual and meaningful with other human beings, then the theatre is a place, perhaps the place, where we can get it. Because theatre demands an audience, a group. It cannot work as a solitary activity. You can watch television on your own. You can go to the cinema on your own. The poor actors, of course, are acting, don't know that you're the only person in the cinema. They've done their job far removed from you. But theatre requires that the audience cease to be individuals and become a community. And having become a community with each other, they then form a community with the actors. This, of course, is best achieved in a theatre in the round, which is what the one I run, in fact, is. The Orange Tree Theatre, the audience surrounds the action, they see the play against a backcloth of fellow members of the audience. Everyone is forced, whether they like it or not, into a relationship with other people, with each other. The end on stage, of course, is a live experience, different from film and television, as is this experience that we're in now, but there's still an element of them and us, of me and you. The audience has their space, and the actors up on the stage have theirs. And so it does at any thrust stage, that is the case. But with a real theatre in the round, the whole dynamic of the experience is changed, and something is created that is entirely different from the end-on film and the television and the computer experience that is so much now part of our lives. And at this point, if I were able and had the courage, and I'm not able, so I don't need the courage this time, I would get down off the stage and make you all move your seats. And I would take up a place in the middle and make you all sit round me, just to make concrete the extraordinary difference in that experience from the end-on experience. And in that experience, of course, the audience is also required to behave differently. With film and television, the director's control is considerable. He or she decides what you are to look at and for how long. The camera cuts from person to person or place to place to direct your attention where the director wants it or simply to keep your attention alert. And even on a conventional stage, I can place the actors in such a way as I am directing you where to look. But in the round, the power is yours. As the play is being seen from all four sides, there's no upstage centre spot, there's no best place to stand, and the audience has to pay attention and decide for itself where to look. And the actors, when rehearsing the play, can allow themselves to behave as required in the scene, as required by what is going on between the characters, instead of merely pretending to do that, while in fact making sure that they are clearly seen from the one side that counts. Theatre in the round demands real audience involvement. And if involving theatre in the round is the best form of theatre to face the future, why, somebody might be storing up a question, are there so few of them, I hear you cry. Well, as the end of the Victorian era was leading to the beginnings of modern theatre, it was also saw the establishment of things like the fire brigade and electric light. Now, with electricity replacing the flickering gas lights and the introduction of some kind of safety precautions, good old theatre fires diminished. And we found ourselves lumbered with the architecture of a particular period, both in terms of the buildings and in terms of the social divisions of the time. So the theatre we all first hear about is the dear old proscenium arch, and we experience it perhaps first as children in the form of that Pollock's toy theatre that you may have been given to play with. And our first visit to the theatre may be to a pantomime in the local rep in a Pross Arch theatre. We've all been indoctrinated to accept that the Pross Arch is what a proper theatre really is. Then, having preserved the buildings from destruction, the powers that be have slapped preservation orders on them. So Shaftesbury Avenue and Broadway and all our great regional cities and pretty well everywhere else where there were theatres find that they have streets full of one particular specific historical form of theatre. And then when new theatres are built, we want the productions to be able to transfer to these old spaces. And we also are too timid to create exciting new spaces for the theatre to face the future with. So now, you see, I have to turn to form an alliance with old Dom Jolly and say what we need is a good old bonfire. Until we have one, theatres in the round, I suspect, will, alas, remain a minority form. And I don't mind that, really, because it helps to give me an identity. But because there are so few of them, I think we're all the worse for it. So theatre must acknowledge and be positive about being what it is. It's a place where the audience need to be involved and committed and respectful of fellow audience members and of the actors, creating a shared experience. It's also a place where ideas can be shared, where people can be provoked and outraged, as well as stimulated and entertained. It's not by chance that one of the first places that repressive regimes clamp down on is theatre. For in this gathering place, playwrights and their actors can encourage their audiences to think and then to act. And how apt it was that the Velvet Revolution in Prague in 1989 should have taken place so largely in theatres and been led by playwright Václav Havel. The theatre can survive if it's true to itself, and then it need not be consigned to the history books. It's not, therefore, a place to send or receive texts or to tweet or to eat. And I've got a photograph here, a Labour Party conference. Odd message, it says, Diane Abbott, Ed Balls and Jamie Reid consult their phones during a conference speech. It is not a place to tweet or eat or drink or text. And if mobile phones go off, let the play stop and the offender be ejected before the action continues, is my policy. There's a bonus wait. It hasn't been claimed yet. There's a bonus waiting for the first actor at the Orange Tree who leads the company off stage and insists that the mobile phone owner is removed from the building. When theatres today encourage people to eat and drink, food and drink being taken in, and even there is talk of having tweet zones in theatre, where while watching, audiences are going to be encouraged to tweet or text about what they're seeing. How can they possibly do that and be paying attention? Beware, Ed Balls. If we are doing that, we are apologising for interrupting their lives, and ultimately, I think we will be signing our own death warrants. Let us hope very much that we don't do that, and that the theatre, as well as having a history, will continue to have a glorious future. Thank you.
For all information, please visit www.gresham.ac.uk.